Today on the AV Podcast, we discuss the recent 25th anniversary of the movie Juice. On part two, I welcome past contributor of South Shore AV, Sean Adonis, as well as first-time guest, Andrew Mabo. They join me to discuss the movie overall. We break down the rise of Tupac, our favorite scenes, the scenarios of power, respect, and peer pressure in the movie. And we ask a long, wondered question such as, how did Q get Yolanda, for example? Plus more. To subscribe to the pod and the blog, make sure you subscribe to SouthShoreAV.com. Once again, that's SouthShoreAV.com. I'm just going to put a little warning slash disclaimer out. This side of the podcast contains some explicit language. So just letting you know, in case you have your little kiddies running around, I don't want to be responsible for letting them hit the playgrounds and letting the kids know what's hot in these cussing streets. It's the AV Podcast with Cal C on South Shore AV Radio. Partner. Riverside, mother.
Welcome to the AV Podcast with Cal C on South Shore AV Radio.
Welcome to the Juice Movie Edition of the AV Podcast. Joining me today as part of the conversation for the 25th anniversary of Juice, I welcome past contributor to South Shore AV, Sean Adonis, and you can catch him on previous AV episodes such as the MVPs of 2016, Jay-Z's Reasonable Doubt, 20th anniversary of that one, and more. What's going on, Sean?
Salutations, my brethren.
Yes, and believe it or not, back in 92, I actually saw this movie with Sean and a couple other friends, I think. You remember that?
Yeah, it was a major outing.
Yeah.
Back then, going to the movies, like, it really felt like we went to Miami, man. Like, it was serious business. Coordinating bus schedules, getting the movie ticket money together, man.
It was a whole thing. All we were missing was some eye candy and some Wet Willies.
Seriously, man.
My second guest is a first-timer to the AV. He's an award-winning radio producer and is currently one of the producers of ESPN's 30 for 30 podcast, which will be out later this year. He also doubles as my fantasy football nemesis. I show this guy lots of love and, you know, I wish him well in real life, but then I also can't stand him and the way he runs his scumbag squads in all of our fantasy leagues. Never in the history of this podcast have I been so personally conflicted with a guest appearance on my show. I'm happy and proud, and I also feel like I've broken a deal with the devil at the same time. I need a shower. ladies and gentlemen, listeners of the pod, please welcome Andrew Mabo to the AV. Hello, Mabo.
How you doing, Calvin? Thank you for having me. It's about time.
Yeah, I guess. I was going to say,
now the appropriate time to, like, ask about compensation. What exactly, how much you pay for?
Yeah, no doubt. Wait till after the show. Wait till after the show. I got you. I got you for sure, Mama. Got you.
I'm going to have some back pay coming to me on top of that. Thanks, Mom. That's what happens when you get a professional involved, man.
Shit.
There you go, man. I used to be in the union, so no longer in the union, but I was before. So I think I also have to give a disclaimer that anything I say, I'm pretty sure will be disavowed by both ESPN and the Disney Corporation.
Yep, so that's the end of that's the end of the podcast today. Well, thank you guys for coming today.
you will be sued.
Don't come back. I have no money. Don't come after me. Please, don't do it. So we're going to talk about the movie today.
Yes.
The classic generational movie, Juice. I'm going to start off with you, Sean. What was the initial pull of the movie that made you gravitate towards it? Or what are your first thoughts when you think of this movie, I should say?
To be quite honest with you, man, I didn't have any expectations going in there. I just thought it was another black movie, young black movie. I figured it'd be about music. I figured it'd be about, you know, a whole bunch of things that young people our age are interested in. You know, music and style and fashion. And, you know, just basically black young American life. I didn't even see the preview, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
So, when I the scene, and I don't even know if this was expected in the movie, but, you know, when it took the twist or the turn from, you know, just being a basic happy-go-lucky group of friends who were vibing and enjoying the urban life to a failed botched robbery turned to the story of a maniac turning on his friends, I was floored. Like, what the hell is going on here, man? Mm-hmm. Like, I was not expecting that much storyline from that movie. I wasn't expecting the writers to get that creative. Like, I really just expected it just to be a celebration of our culture, and at the end we'd be like, man, it's great to be black. Like, that's what I expected. So, I gotta say, when I went in there, man, I was floored, I was impressed, I was disturbed. It was just a whole culmination of emotions, man.
Hey, man, I'm a bit surprised, because the first line you said, you just thought it was just going to be another movie about black youth. And I had the opposite reaction in that I was surprised to see a movie about black youth. Like, it was so rare at that time, I felt. And I remember, I'm surprised you guys were actually able to go see it in the theater, because I felt like it was in the theater for all of, like, a weekend in Montreal. And I missed it totally.
I'm sure it
was. I don't know if you guys were in Toronto. Maybe in Toronto it was out for a week, but, like, it was in and out of the theaters fast in a blink of an eye. So I saw it like on VHS much later, after the fact. But I remember being excited about seeing young people that look like us. Because up to that point, I mean, I don't think there were a lot of, you know, movies that had been, you know, like that. There were also, like, starring young people. And even Boys in the Hood, weren't most of those guys like in their late 20s?
No, they were like early 20s too, I believe.
Were they?
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
because like those Boys in the Hood is one. I mean, but other than that, because after Juice, there was a whole bunch.
Right.
I know that.
Right.
It was like a number, like 92, 93, 94, yeah. Yeah, 95, like all those years, it was like numerous.
Yeah.
But I remember at Juice, that was the thing that stood out for me the most, was that it really felt unique seeing young people like that, just being carefree. Well, at least in the beginning, being carefree. It got real quick.
Yeah.
Scary real, for real.
For me, I think the initial pull that got me, because I remember seeing maybe a couple of previews, and I remember seeing the Rakim video for it, the No to Ledge video. But for me, I think the pull for it was that you knew it was black, you knew it was youthful, it was hip-hop. It sounded like us. It dressed like us. So immediately, that worked as a gravitational pull towards me and like Sean and some of my friends that we had back in the day to go see that movie. And, you know, the movie came right after the success of, like, you know, Boys in the Hood and New Jack City, as well as the rise of, like, Spike Lee with Do the Right Thing, More Better Blues, Jungle Fever, you know, and actually even House Party too. So, you know, so when you add all that up, it was a given that for us that the theaters were going to get our money, you know. And I feel like too, like the success for black movies in the early 90s, where it was trendsetting and it really aligned itself to the culture that it was birthed from, you know, it also affected just pop culture as well, you know, in a sense too. So for me, like, just thinking of those times, like, you know, when I reflect back on it, that's what I think of. But back then, yeah, I think I was just excited just to see people our age on the screen. That was just a pull in itself. So just seeing a couple of their previews and saying, okay. And I mean, I can't remember exactly how it came about that I ended up going to the movie with Sean, but Sean, I felt the same way like you did. You were just constantly perplexed the whole time watching the movie.
Yeah, man. Like, I remember when that epic scene happened after the old man Quilla's botched robbery situation, man, I was like, holy shit. I mean, I'm sure we'll probably get into this into a deeper context later, but I was like, wait. That's not supposed to happen. Like, the movie took a left turn from where I expected it to go.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I didn't think it was going to be a house party. You know what I mean? I didn't think it was going to be that level of glee, but, I mean, I didn't expect it to go there. Like, that didn't make any sense to me. And I was like, whoa. Like, I was at the edge of my seat after that, man.
Yeah.
It's very much like the anti-house party type film.
Yeah,
it was a complete 180. There was no Running Man and Kickstep between Bishop and Q, no. Right?
No. And the thing that was different about that, when you compare it to movies like Boys in the Hood and New Jack City. Like, those movies set the context early, so you knew what to expect. You understood what kind of movie it was, right? But with Juice, obviously it was brilliantly, purposely done this way. They just, you know, made it more so a chilling movie, just establishing, you know, the relationships between the Youngs brothers and friendships and this and that. So, you know, you really got into the feel of, you know, the relationships between them all, and then it just pulled the rug right from under you. Like, whoa! You know, like, instantly you were thrown into disarray. It was, like, crazy. It was brilliantly done, I gotta say. But, you know, like, some movies you watch, and you see it coming, like, okay, I know this is about to happen. Like, nobody saw this happening, man.
It was interesting. I mean, it does really look at, like, these four young guys who at one point were all probably very much similar, you know, had the same kind of ambitions, were looking for the same things, and you're seeing them as they grow up, and they really, like, get this pivotal moment where they all divide, right?
Right.
Hugh doesn't really want to go along with it. You know, Raheem wants to do it in a certain way. Bishop is obviously off the rails completely, and Steele is just along for the ride.
Right.
And they all, like, they're all on these very different, you know, trajectories, but they're all starting, they all, you know, like, obviously they started in the same place. That's how they became friends. And that kind of thing, for me, I remember at that time, was like, you know, similar thing going on with some of my friends. It's like, you know, people just start going in different directions.
Yeah.
People take, you know, stuff happens, people go, you know, in different ways, and you kind of deal with the same kind of things. So I thought, I always found that to be like a fascinating aspect of it, is like how they kind of deal with that.
Yeah, great point, actually.
Yeah. And for me, I kind of agree with you with that, Sean, as well. Just, it was well written. Like, even looking back on it, just, you know, the last, like, few weeks or so, it was a well written movie. And mm-hmm. and just how they wrote in just the relationships between all four of them. And as you said, Mambo, like, they you know, they ended up going their separate ways and straying, but for the most part, at least in the beginning, they're very much a unit. And just, I think it really captured the closeness of everybody, just everybody's relationships, interrelationships. You know, you saw the relationships between Q and Raheem. You had a little moments like at the arcade between Bishop and Steele, you know, so like you just saw like the little interplay between everybody, so it really kind of roped you in. So by the time it got to, like, you know, the climax scene, you were really invested in it after that point. You know, it's kind of like, you know, yeah. What it reminds me of, it's kind of like I mean, this was much later, of course, but it's kind of like The Wire. Remember the season four of The Wire, when it was about the four kids? And just how they wrote you in for the whole season, and then when Michael turned, you were just like, oh my god, no, Michael. Like,
yeah.
Like, you're so invested at that point. Like you felt like that was like your family member that turned rogue.
Yeah.
So that's what this kind of reminds me of. It's just like you were so invested in just what they were doing, and then by the time that happened, you were just, you know, you were kind of beside yourself. But I kind of want to touch on, you know, the main point of the movie, which is basically, you know, the power and respect aspect of the movie, hence the name Juice. Is the basic principles of Juice is that it's a movie about power, respect, and peer pressures of teenage life. You know, they all want to get respect from the streets, from their peers, respect from, you know, from authority, old man Quiles, police, everybody, you know. And I think when it comes to the power and respect aspect, I feel like Raheem and Bishop, they were the guys that were really looking out for that out of the four guys. I think even though he was a de facto leader of his friends, the situation with his baby mother somewhat emasculated him, you know, Raheem, I should say, especially seeing him run off with Special Ed, you know, just because Special Ed, you know, he made the song I Got It Made and he had baby curls and he had the red car. She didn't have to go with him like that. And then, and you know, of course, Bishop seemed volatile. And it's funny because in the beginning of the movie, you kind of saw the aspect of the lack of foundation that he had. You know, he had his grandmother there. It didn't seem like there was a mother around. And his father was dealing with some sort of mental issue. Because you remember, he was just zoned out in front of the TV every time they showed him.
Mm-hmm.
He was always getting jumped by Radames and his crew, you know, and just angry about just not being more respected. And
yeah,
then...
Hold on. Before you go too far,
yeah.
Could we just address the fact of how improbable it was that someone like Special Ed would have paid any attention to Raheem's baby mother, the way she looked?
Oh, man.
Let's be serious, man. He was way out of her league and could do way better than her. So unless
without even being special,
just the car alone,
just being random Puerto Rican guy.
Yeah, the car alone plus the the curly hair, man. Come on, man, dude could have done better than her. Jeez. Even Raheem, I don't know what kind of skills she had, in the sheets, in the sack. Because she was pulling some dudes that were way above her caliber.
You're trying to say it was above her pay grade?
Yeah, man. I don't know, man. They both got done way better than her. I don't know what her skills were, her skill set was, but it must have been pretty impressive.
I guess it was amazing.
It seems so. I don't know.
I like what the point you were mentioning about Bishop's dad, though. I think is an important thing because it adds like a certain layer of complexity to his character, right?
Right.
But on one night, you take that scene away, like with his grandma and his dad. You take that out. He's much less of a sympathetic character. He's much less, it's much easier to just hate him and not really even think about where he's come from. Like you said, like he's lacking a foundation. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you enter that, you make his character a little more complex, which is subtle because it's just in the beginning. But it's genius in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even like all of those little subtleties of like what these guys' relationships are like at home. Steele has his dad. Like they make it quite clear. Steele's father is still at home.
Yeah.
Now, he might be like, rushing him off to school. And his dad's obviously working a blue collar job. I think he was like a postman or something. Like you saw he had like a uniform. Like he's there. They're making intentional statements about the different households that these guys are coming from, which is subtle, but it's definitely interesting, especially in 1992 when this kind of like thing was not happening. The norm at that time was probably more along the lines of a house party would have been the easier sell.
Yeah.
Just like simple kind of Joker characters that have no depth. They give each one of these characters, they give them intense depth very subtly, which is fascinating.
Good point, Mr. Radio Producer. Goodness gracious.
Hey, man.
You're on a roll here, aren't you, man?
I'm just a fan of the movie. You don't understand. But Calvin, you asked me about this movie specifically. I think this is like one movie that I could properly have this conversation with. Like, I've watched this movie numerous times back in the day. And I think it had that, like, was one of the things I recognized about this movie even back then was just that, like, thing about the complexity of these characters, like, how diverse it was. Like, it was much more real. I mean, granted, like, I mentioned about that divergence of the characters, like, how they're all kind of going their own separate ways. I mean, it happens in the movie, it happens in a matter of, like, a few days. But in reality, that was something that I think a lot of us kind of went through over a protracted period of time, right? Like from your friends you have when you're in high school aren't the same as like when you go to, CJEP and then when you go on to university, work. Like
that's the truth.
Kind of changes.
That's the truth. Because think about the friends you had when you're in seventh grade. So by the time you got to 11th grade, some of them made it, but some of them didn't. And then that transition from then to like even now, like are most of those people still there? You might have met some new people that might have replaced that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's funny, can you touch on that? Because Q, like, he had aspirations to be a DJ, and for him, he probably saw a better life for him than how he was living currently. But, like, the whole power respect thing wasn't his priority. I think if he wanted that, he wanted it to come from DJing, like, his passion and his craft, And,
right.
And he had that drive to be great at something. And then to touch on Steele now, Steele was just Steele. Like, as you mentioned before, he's chilling, happy-go-lucky guy that was more or less down with whatever the majority of his friends were doing, which was basically relatable to approximately millions of what teenagers were doing, when they're at that stage of life. They're just following the crowd kind of thing. So it's like if they decided, they wanted to be honor roll students, Steele would have got A's. You know what I mean? Like, decided they wanted to skateboard, like, he would have had like the red skateboard. You know what I mean? Like, I think he's a character that, he was more or less not a pushover, but, he basically flowed. Like, he just went with the flow. So the whole respect and juice thing, that didn't really fly with him really either. You know what I mean? Like, that wasn't part of his character. To me, and I think we kind of spoke about this offline, I think the power of peer pressure, I think to me was like another aspect of the movie that I thought was prevalent all throughout. Because, I mean, the power peer pressure is what got the best of Q. Because clearly that guy didn't want to, he didn't want to do anything that jeopardized his path as a DJ. Which is probably another reason why he fought so hard against Bishop during that potential, you know, the barroom robbery with Blizzard. You know, remember the guy that that basically stuck up the barroom scene and ended up getting to the shootout with the police and died? Back at Steel's house, he had that whole back and forth beef with Bishop. But I think that's where it resonated from, because, you know, like, he saw it as...
Broke his mama's face.
Yeah. and but he saw it as, yo, like, are you crazy? Like, what do you want a piece of that for? And Bishop looking at him like, you're nuts. Like, yo, dude, we can get this action.
Yeah, no, I remember that. Yeah, it's true, man. And the funny thing is, like you said, peer pressure in this movie is such a major thing because, you know, he was focused. He knew what he wanted to do, and he really just participated based on his sense of loyalty to his group of friends, man, because he wanted absolutely no part in this. He had other things that were priority to him and knew where he wanted to go, and, like, he just was basically roped into this by the pressure to not, you know, turn his back on his friends, man.
And by Raheem specifically, right? Like, the whole thing is, this group of guys is probably a group of friends that been around for, they've been together for a long time, but at this point in the film, these guys are just being held together by Raheem. Like, Raheem is like this bridge between them. He's the middle of the road, right? He's like the leader, but he's also like bridging between them. He has aspirations, probably not quite the same as like he does, but he wants to do something. He doesn't want to go down the murderous route, which is like just getting respect for respect's sake, which is what Bishop wants. So, like, he's kind of holding this crew together. As soon as he's out of the picture, Q and Bishop are just, like, not only because Bishop actually killed them, which is obviously a good reason to have a rift, but, like, there's generally just nothing that keeps these guys together. Like, even before the shooting, the only thing keeps this crew together is Raheem. And the moment that's lost, there's no way back.
But I'll ask you guys a question. What is it about peer pressure, though, especially at the teenage age, that has so much power over you?
It's that need to fit in, man. Like, it's that feeling that if you are an outsider, if you don't fit in, then it's, like, catastrophic. Like, it's the end of the world, man. And I tell my son this all the time. I'm like, just in general, things that made you an outlier or made you stand out in a negative way when you were in high school seemed like it would be the end of the world, man. Like, I remember certain things, you know, certain things that were either embarrassing or anything like that. It just made it seem like it was such a seismic event and had such major impact on your life. And then as an adult now, I look back and I'm like, wow, man, none of those things mattered at all. But when you're at that age, you think that these types of things map out the rest of your life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's the end of the world.
Yeah. So you basically crumble the peer pressure just because you don't want to have such a significant impact, negative impact on your life. But I guess you're not mature enough, or, you know, you haven't had enough life experience to realize that, you know, you don't really, it's not the end of the world if you go against the grain, man. But at that age, sometimes, especially when it comes to, you know, like we established this group of friends where camaraderie was everything between them, it feels like to go against that, it's like, you know, you're going against, it's such a major infraction, and you just can't really bring yourself to do it.
Yeah.
But what he said. But, like, I mean, I think that when you look at it, I think the peer pressure affects them different, right? Like, Steel is the kind of character who's kind of doing what everybody else is going to do. So he's just kind of going along. He almost just doesn't want to be noticed, right? Like, you just want to coast. That kind of, those people that respond to peer pressure in that way. And to me, Q almost seems like he's responding to it in a way of, like, he's not really going along just for going along's sake. He just sees it as something he has to do. Like, it's like a respect of the streets type thing.
Right.
Where if he doesn't do it, what is the down, you know what I mean? Like, what are people going to say about him if he doesn't go along with it? Versus,
what's the consequences, basically?
Yeah. Versus, like, Steel, where he feels like, keep your head down. And which a lot of people went through high school like that, you know, where you just kind of, you'd rather just get by. you don't want to get attention. It's the best way to go about it.
Yeah, like I said, just more or less going with the flow, you know. And it's funny because that whole scene, I think that brought it all together was obviously the shooting of Omar Quiles. They had the, you know, they had the money already, but and it was obviously there was no reason for him to die. I'm sorry, I'm laughing about this because over the weekend, Mambo sent me a Facebook page was dedicated to dedicated to Omar Quiles.
RIP page for Omar Quiles.
So I'm like, people got too much time on their hands, man. Because why would you create that? And it was like 26 members, wasn't it?
Yeah, I know. People joined that page, man.
There was actually people who joined the page. I'm like, I'm sorry, yeah. that popped in my head for a second. But, you know.
People commented, too.
I remember where I was when old man Quiles died. I laid flowers at the bodega, you know. It's ridiculous, but... But yeah, but going back to Bishop, I mean, just the thrill of power was just, it was enough to overpower his sensibilities. Once he got a taste of that, he wasn't giving that shit up for no one, not even his friends, you know. And it's funny, I'm actually surprised after he shot Raheem that he didn't actually shoot Q right after he killed him. Like, just because at by that point, you know, their relationship was kind of rocky, even in the movie, when Q was mentioning that, you know, he wants to do his DJing competition. You know, like it annoyed Bishop in the movie. You know what I mean? So it's like, so by then, by the time he shot him, it was like, I'm looking back, you're kind of surprised, you know, like Q didn't get one right then and there too.
Bishop needed people to follow him, right? So I think his whole thing was he gets rid of the leader, who was the leader, get rid of him. Now he's the leader because he's the one holding the peace. He's the one that's got the juice. Every leader needs followers. So I think like his whole thing, like I think he just thought that he would be de facto the new leader and everybody follow in line. Wasn't exactly the case.
No. That's definitely how it worked.
That's a pretty great point that I never considered, to be quite honest with you. I was just like, man, that fellow Dip is crazy. And I was like, how the hell did that guy hide the craziness for so long? Like, you know, he was sitting there enjoying everybody's company the whole time. And when him and Q got into that fight that Raheem made them squash earlier, he didn't bash his head with one of his grandmother's, you know, decorations or anything like that. I was like, wow, I mean, I didn't see this level of lunacy coming at all, man. And then I figured it was like Pandora's box. Once you opened up the crazy, you couldn't stuff it back in.
This guy goes on to shoot Rodman in the back in broad daylight, man.
I know.
He went
on a tear, man.
Yeah, but that's the only thing. Like, I guess, you know, it's to that degree of cavalier. I won't say insanity, but you know, just, well, I guess I can't think of another word. Insanity. It was a little overdone, but it is a movie, you know. Like, to go from, like, I never did nothing to nobody to I murder anyone that bothers me within 3 or 4 days is a little extreme.
They only had 90 minutes, my man.
Exactly.
You got to make that turn quick.
but I was going to say, at the same time, too, though, there were signs that stuff was building, right? So from the whole time he's getting bullied by Rodamez and his crew and, you know, different things like that. Like, just the whole aspect of him and Rodamez. And first of all, I love Rodamez. Rodamez to me is hilarious. Every time I see him in when he pops up in the movie, it makes me laugh. But yeah, like I think
bad actor.
This is also like
a big, you know, Rodamez is the reason Bishop happens, right? Like, this is a whole anti-bullying film. You know?
Yeah, that too.
Bishop is bullied, and then he lashes out because he can't lash out at the people who really bothered him. You know, he lashed out at old man Quiles. Poor old man Quiles, man. It's not fair. Right.
He suffered
for Rodamez's crimes.
He just wanted to make a living.
He just wanted to run his bodega. That's all he wanted.
He just wanted to run his bodega, man.
They could have just taken the money and run.
Bodega. He was never really going to shoot anybody. He's just threatening them. What was his line? I'm going to shoot your pee-pee off. comes out with a little six-shooter. He was never going to hurt anybody, man. Probably thing wasn't even loaded. And so, like, I think it's the whole thing of, you know, this guy gets bullied, and who does he lash out at? Whoever he can.
Everybody,
well,
basically.
Eventually he does come at Rodamez, so.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. He basically lashes out at everybody. But I'll ask another question here. Another aspect here. I'm just thinking of now. Like, how important is the like a strong figurehead or strong foundation in the household? Like, basically, I asked that because the two guys that wanted the power, if you look at, you know, especially the beginning of the movie, like, I love the beginning of it because it kind of sets up everybody's character. Like, you see Q, like, he's sleeping in his bed, you know, he's sleeping with his headphones on, the records, you know, still playing, and the mother comes in, you know, she's the dominant personality of the house, the dominant figure in the house. I'm not sure if he had a father in the movie. I can't remember that part. I don't think so. But either way, she more than handled it. Yeah, she more than handled it at that point, you know, and mm-hmm. he got up and got ready. Steele had his, you know, he had his father in there. His father, you know, got in his ass to get up in the morning. Raheem didn't, it seemed like that was more like a cool kind of like, you know, like a cool like atmosphere in the household because he had that little playful thing with his sister, you know, trying to fight for the bathroom, that type of thing. And then, you know, then you see the, like I said before, you see the dark point with Bishop in the movie in terms of just the stark contrast between the three of them, like how his was just, it seemed like it was the most, like it was just lacking anything positive at that point, you know?
Yeah, the most dysfunctional.
Yeah, it's the most dysfunctional, that's the word. But yeah, so how important is that strong figurehead in the household just based on the four characters?
I mean, I don't think that this movie's trying to like necessarily make that connection, because that seems, so what Bishop does is not, you know, he kind of goes off on his own. He doesn't follow somebody's orders and does things, which is where you could maybe throw that on, like saying you don't have a strong household figure who's leading you and teaching you the way, then you're going to just like be susceptible to peer pressure and you're going to do things that other people are telling you to do.
Right.
But what Bishop does is, Bishop is, I don't know which one, but he's a sociopath or a psychopath, one or the other, because he's completely dissociated from what he does. You know what I mean? And he's not being told to do what he does by anybody. He's doing it all of his own. He's just like completely, he kills his quote unquote friend and a good friend from like a long time, presumably, shoots him dead and has no issues about it. They go back to the party, they DJ and everything. They get pulled into the police station and he's cool as anything, smoking cigarettes, like nothing happened. You know what I mean?
Where he's coming from,
it's not really about, to me, that aspect
at all.
Yeah, it's gone. Like, there's no sense of remorse. There's no nothing. There's no, like, he's not connected to that in any, like, way that makes him feel that what he did was wrong. He blames him. He's like, he shouldn't have tried to touch the gun. He shouldn't have tried to take the gun from me. Like, it's Raheem's fault. So, you know, he got what happened to him. Whereas, if it was a case of him not having a father figure, then it'd be more like he was just doing what an older guy told him to do and killed a bunch of people. Mm-hmm. Man, Bishop's crazy, bro. Bishop is crazy. There's no like father figure issue. The man is nuts.
Yeah, it's a strong mental issue going on there.
That's a good point. I don't know if any big brother program or mentorship could have affected that level of psychology.
No, man. Nothing. His like nothing could have helped this guy like that. He could have had his mama could have been there. He'd probably shot her too. He's crazy.
Yo, that's an amazing point. But Mambo, as good of a point as that is, I think that maybe the writers of the movie were trying to show what Calvin was trying to say. I don't think they thought it through to that degree because they're not professional radio producers like yourself.
You gotta stop. You gotta stop.
But I think that what they were trying to show was really that level of dysfunction, lack of a father figure. I don't know, maybe, but I think they're just trying to show the level of
had
dysfunction.
A lack of a father figure.
Pardon me?
But most of them had a lack of a father figure.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm like for me, I'm not saying necessarily a father figure. I'm just saying just a strong figure in the household.
Yeah, or just a level of dysfunction. I think they were trying to show, you know, like you said, the rest of them came from fairly healthy households where Tupac's or Bishop's was like just completely unhealthy environment, lack of love, or not necessarily love. I think his grandmother was straight, but I mean, his father was completely despondent. And, you know, they're just trying to show that things weren't cool at his household. And that may have played. And later on, when you saw that he was like straight bananas in pajamas, you were like, okay. maybe his household has something to do with molding this level of, you know, craziness.
Or at least it didn't help.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like, his dad was just stuck in front of the TV watching The Price is Right all day.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And one thing, too, what is something else that you know, kind of helped certain characters perhaps go toward, like you said before, Mambo, mm-hmm. they drifted apart or went in their particular paths. One thing that helped Q stay grounded, I think, was the fact that he so inexplicably was banging that girl from a Vogue that was so much older than him.
Yeah, we'll touch on that part a little bit later, though. We will get to that. We will definitely get to that.
Fucking cougar pedophile chick. Madness.
To her defense, Q was like probably 22 years old in that film.
Well, let's
that guy was like, that guy was like a super duper senior in that film.
Yeah, he was supposed to be a high schooler, which is like,
so are you trying to say he fell back a few grades?
And that guy did like the 12th grade. First, I have to go to 12th grade here, and that guy did the 12th grade like 4 or 5 times for sure.
He's the only one in 12th grade with a 401k plan.
Exactly. So that installment to get his diploma installment plan. Let me do 1 year at a time. Let me just do like one class at a time.
Let's touch on the rise of Tupac in this movie, because obviously this movie was a launching pad for all four actors basically, but three of them especially. Omar Epps, Khalil Kane, and Tupac all went from, you know, being huge stars after this movie came out. Khalil Kane became somewhat of a sex symbol for a lot of women during the 90s. I swear, every movie premiere that I went to in the 90s, when he was in it, it was usually followed by some sort of catcalling every time he entered the scene for the first time.
Are you sure?
I'm absolutely positive. Women loved Raheem, Sean.
Name two Khalil Kane movies. Name two Khalil Kane movies.
Yeah, exactly. They loved him in the movie. After that, he just fell into obscurity. I think he was on Girlfriend, man, like that. Where else was he?
Girlfriends don't count.
Oh, no, that's true.
What else was he on? On two feature films, man. Name two.
You just ruined that one point for me. Help y'all.
Yeah, I don't know.
No, nice but I remember like certain, I guess it wasn't like big parts, but it seemed like every time he was in it, he was some sort of like a sex symbol to me, at least from what
I
you
think
see.
You're just thinking like every light-skinned guy that was in the movies in the 90s was Khalil Kane.
Well, that too, because I wasn't really part of Team Light Skin. You know, I was Team Dark Skin all day. So
yeah, exactly.
So maybe it was just that forever beef. I don't know.
Yeah, but, just hating.
but Omar Epps went on. He became a big actor afterwards. He did Higher Learning. Women loved him in Love and Basketball. He married my crush Keisha from Total. but Tupac had the highest ceiling out of all of them. And
yeah, definitely.
And I'll say this, like when compared to everything else that he did in his career, like the movies, the major videos, all the controversies, East Coast, West Coast beef, the major albums, the other acting roles, the Death Row move. Do you guys feel like this is portrayal of Bishop is underrated when you look back on it?
What's crazy when you think about it, what you just said is like how he, you know, he was on the up and all that kind of thing. The man was dead 18 months from the premiere of this film.
It was that soon?
No, I don't think so.
September,
it was that soon.
September 1993, man.
No. He died in 96.
No. He died in 97. Sorry.
96.
Yeah. Biggie was in 97 then, right?
Yeah.
93. Yeah, you're right. All right. So but the point being, it was a short period of time. I mean, you're talking like 4 or 5 years, and the guy's gone. In that time, he went from like, he just blew up. Which is, it's just crazy to do it in that period, in that, you know, short amount of time at such a young age too.
Yeah.
But I do think though that role really launched his career though, because I don't think before that so many people that weren't already fans of West Coast hip hop were really checking for Pac like that. I know I wasn't personally.
Yeah.
And after that, after he his brilliant depiction in that role, like he was did an amazing job in that role. I mean, I couldn't imagine anybody else in that role, and I'm not sure who else was up for it, but he made that movie, absolutely. Because you could, to be honest with you, in my opinion, you could have interchanged any of the other characters with anybody else, and the film would have been pretty much the same.
Well, except Steele being the leader, but go on.
But, you know, but Popto, his portrayal of Bishop in that movie, man, it launched him. It gave, and people even looked at that, and, you know, it kind of made you even think, like, man, Pac's a badass, you know? Because it was so well done, you made the correlation between Bishop and Pac. Like, that's, yo, he's, it just made him like, yo, he's like that dope. And people just, like, you know, women from then started loving him, and dudes started idolizing him, and then he started, or I can't say started, but his music career really took off. And so I think that movie definitely did help catapult him into the direction of stardom that he achieved before his early demise.
For sure. And then, like, just on acting chops, what was the movie he did where, I'm trying to remember, with the British dude,
Oh, I know you're talking about
Tim Rock, where they were drug addicts.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of the movie, but I know you're talking. There were two cops,
Gridlock,
right?
It's the other one.
Was it something like that? Or?
What's it called?
Is it Gridlock?
Or Wanted? Or I'm going to Google it. Go on.
Oh, Gridlock.
Is it Gridlock? That movie was like, that was when you're like, this guy can really act. I mean, he took it to another level. Yeah. I mean, that was a dual threat, man. For sure, proper.
It's true, man. I mean, but then again, and then you found out later on that, you know, he was theater school with Jada Pinkett, and so it wasn't as haphazard as you may have thought if you didn't know. But he definitely was talented, man.
Yeah, I agree, because that role, I mean, he played that shit a little too good, because I think after a while it almost floated into, I think, I don't know if some people thought that. That was him, but it didn't feel like a total stretch that he was playing somebody way different than who he was at that point. Maybe he wasn't to that extreme of being crazy. You know, clearly in his life, you kind of saw little resemblances of Bishop, you know, when he was wilding out, especially when he was on death row. It's funny how it kind of imitated life a little bit, you know, like the art imitated life a little bit afterwards.
I mean, and think about it this way. In no way, shape, or form was he's someone that you should have, with your character, that you should have admired in any way. But Tupac managed to pull it off that even after he murdered one of his best friends, you saw certain things, you're like, man, that's a cool son of a bitch. You know, like I mean, think of it. The scenes when he was, when Q was in the, was looking in his locker and closed the locker door and Bishop was there. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And
creepy as hell.
And the scenes where, you know, he was in the elevator staring Q down, like just staring at him with like a dead look in his eyes, and you were looking like, man, that's some cool shit too. Like, so much stuff after you should have been like, man, I hate this guy, man. Mm-hmm. But you couldn't help with the whole Riverside quote. Like, you couldn't help but say, son of a bitch, you're an asshole, but you're a cool guy, man. Like,
Every
you
respect, you're like, yeah, it's scary, but man,
but
God damn it,
I respect
guy,
you.
Yeah. For me, man, it was the scene when he emerges out of the shadows, you know, in the scene when he sets up the meeting with Q. After Q throws away the gun and then he's waiting for him, and Bishop just comes out of nowhere, out of the shadow. The thing I remember the most about that is actually one of the reasons I did film when I went to see Jeff, and I remember trying to emulate that scene, that, like, from a cinematography perspective, the coolness of that scene was pretty amazing. The way he steps out in the shadow, like he's just not there, and then all of a sudden he appears. It's pretty.
Yeah, something. like us West Indians say, like a duppy.
Yeah, out of nowhere.
Like you know, you don't even want to
creepy,
rub.
Creepy as hell.
Yeah, you don't even want to rub holy water. You want to drink it down, just guzzle it back, head back, and everything. When you see that scene, I don't know. For me, it's just the callous way that he basically turned on his friends. I don't know. It was just so off-putting to me. Like, honestly, it'd be like me pulling out a gun and turning it on you guys in this podcast right now. Like, just the way he flipped it back. Like, it was just, to me, it was just weird. It was just really, it was just
during the fantasy football season. I wouldn't put that past you, though.
Well, no, that's true. I don't promote violence, you know, except for Mambo. I'll edit that part out. Maybe I will.
Well, that goes further to my point that, like, this wasn't really about missing a father figure bad. This is about a guy who's just straight up crazy. Yeah, man. No father figure, like, just not having a father figure. If that was the case, man, there'd be a lot more friendly homicides.
I think his father might have been crazy, and that was just to show that the crazy gene.
There's some mental on there. Yeah. There's some mental illness in the family.
Yeah, maybe so.
The way his father was, I think when he heard the news, hey, by the way, you know Bishop or Ronald or whatever the heck his real name was, you know he murdered his friend and tried to kill the other ones, and he's in jail now, eh? He would have looked away and looked right back at The Price is Right. I don't see a huge emotional response from that guy, so.
No. But yeah, but that star turn for Tupac was crazy because, I mean, around that time, I mean, I know you're saying that you weren't really into this stuff, but for me, I've always been a Tupac fan. Just, you know, like, I mean, even around that time, he had Brenda's Got a Baby. You know, I love Keep Your Head Up. That was, like, one of my favorite songs from him. And, you know, that kind of came around the same time that movie took off, you know. And then I think after that, mm-hmm. you know, he went into doing, like, Poetic Justice, and he put out some more music, you know. And then he had, like, Above the Rim, and that led to, like, a whole bunch of other stuff. But you're right. I just feel like when you look back at Tupac's career, and every time they have, like, the shows about his career and, you know, flashing back to everything else, it always trips me out that they don't really talk about Juice a lot. I always feel like it's kind of like an underrated moment, even though I think that was the moment that really took him to superstardom.
Yeah, definitely, man.
Yeah.
You know,
it was definitely, like I said, something that catapulted his career. Like you said, I should say, and I co-signed that.
Right. Catapulting all these guys, well, except Steel and whatever movies that Khalil Khan did that you went to see in the theater there, Calvin.
Yeah, maybe it was my hate on him. I don't know. Maybe I was that one guy that quietly gave the Tiger Woods fist pump when he got shot. Maybe that was me. Maybe it was.
I feel like, to make your point, like, you probably have been Googling Khalil Khan movies for the last, like, 10, 15 minutes, and you just still haven't found one yet.
But one that wasn't straight to video, anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. 2000 era Jean-Claude Van Damme, straight to DVD. Like, I actually went somewhere and saw that this man, Jean-Claude Van Damme, makes a movie every year for the last, like, 15, 20 years that nobody knows about.
Still?
Yeah. That man was still making movies for a long time. And Steven Seagal still be making movies?
Come on. You gotta be kidding me.
Nah, go look it up, man.
He's still an action star, or he's making movies, he's an old dude looking like regular dramas? He can't be doing action.
I mean, what was Steven Seagal ever really doing, except just, he didn't have to do much action, man. He's just breaking people's arms. You can do that when you're old.
Did he ever get touched in his movies?
But I think at his age now,
I think it was in his contract. Can't mess up that hair either.
True.
You know what? One thing I'll add though about the role of Bishop. When I was younger, I can't lie, I always wanted to hop the fence like Tupac when they were running from the cops. I swear. I mean, yo, it didn't take much to impress me back then. But even to this day, when I see it, I'm like, we all hop the fence at some point in our lives. But I'm like, I've never seen anybody do that shit before or since. I always wanted to do that. I don't know. I thought that was amazing. Even watching it recently, I'm like, I don't know how you did that.
That's true, man. Actually, that was pretty impressive, actually.
Man. I can't lie. But, all right, so I'm going to ask some random questions here about the movie and everything else. I'll ask, why was Raheem the leader of the crew? I genuinely want to know why. Was it also because of his baby hair, like special ed?
Man, the light skin
racism.
That nice hair, brother.
Shade politics right there.
No, but honestly though, why was he the leader of the crew? Like, why was he deemed the leader of the crew?
His character. You're talking about the actor, or you talking about the character?
No, I'm talking about the character. Like, why was he deemed the leader of the crew?
I mean, he was just like, he. I mean. in the short time that he's in the film, he's the peacemaker. He's the obvious like link between these guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like, he's the one that he has ambitions like Q. He's pretty chill like Steel, and he's ready to go out and do what needs to be done like Bishop. So he's kind of the one that's got a bit of each of their personalities in him, which probably, you know, just makes him the glue that keeps them all together. Which is why when he's gone, it comes completely undone.
So it wasn't because he was on Team Light Skin. He was the captain of the Light Skin team. It wasn't because of that.
Well, I mean, it didn't hurt. I think in the 90s, that didn't hurt.
No.
The only thing that really hurt the Light Skin, Team Light Skin in the 90s was damn those house party movies. Making kids such a goof. And then he reprised that. You remember that movie? What's that stupid movie? Class Act?
Don't even talk about
Jesus.
That.
Don't Every even movie that guy did just made like light skinned people look like clowns. Did not help, man.
Well, out of process of elimination, the leader couldn't be Bishop because he was too much of a live wire, right?
Right.
From the beginning. It couldn't be Steels because, I mean, he was fat. And, I mean, he was... And perception is everything. So, you know, no one was going to fall on the fat, sloppy guy. Just be serious. I mean, and Q wasn't vocal enough. Q wasn't vocal enough or charismatic enough. And I really want to get to how he bagged that girl, which is another reason why he shouldn't have bagged her. If Raheem bagged the girl from En Vogue, that would have been more realistic. But Q, he wasn't enough of a wordsmith to even get her attention, in my opinion. But anyway.
She was dating one of the writers. They wrote her a little part. She did not need to be in the movie, man, except for eye candy, and she was probably dating somebody who wrote it, or like the writer, director, producer, or something.
And what's wrong with that?
Her being in the movie was fine. Her being in the movie was fine because she was from En Vogue. I mean, she was...
Don't get it twisted. I need to cut you off because don't get it twisted. I'm not saying she didn't... But I'm saying from a logistical standpoint, older woman who's like working as an ER nurse, which means she's gone to school for X number of years. She's got to be in her like late 20s, early 30s.
She was already married at that point.
Which means, I mean, I think maybe Omar Epps might have you know, had a good relationship with the producers. Be like, come on, just give me some action in the movie, man. Just, you know what I mean?
I'm trying to like get this girl from En Vogue. I really think if we should be great in this film.
She's a real bum if you think about it. I mean, she was a nurse, she had a career, and then she's messing with a high school student? Man, she's a lowlife.
I need the backstory of how they meet.
Yeah.
Like, how does she meet, how does an ER nurse meet a high schooler to start dating, and then, like, make him candlelit dinners in her house?
Seriously.
She's cooking, and she's, like, mad at him, and his friends are calling for him at her house.
Yeah, it's true.
Something is off.
It's not a secret.
It's really off.
It's true. It wasn't even a secret. You know what I mean? Because... that just shows how the times are different. That's the same times when Belvin DeVoe had that song backstage, underage. We was all dancing, didn't think anything was wrong with it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Completely different culture. Because these days, she'd be like, listen, Q, I'm going to throw you the bill, but you can't tell nobody about this because they're going to arrest me. You know what I mean? Like
I'm going to go to jail.
Yeah, like what you see now when you look on Worldstar, like all these teachers that throw the booty to some high schoolers, and like, that stuff doesn't fly these days. But I guess back then we was like, you know, it's an older woman and a younger guy. It's not really molestation. The guy wants it anyway. You know what I mean? It was a different time.
You're basically rooting for Q, man, at that point.
Yeah.
Poor Q. Poor guy.
Hey, pretty much
then
the
again,
same way you're rooting for high school kids these days. It's just not politically correct to do it when it's a guy and an older woman. You know what I mean? You gotta pretend it's disgusting.
Again, to my earlier point, I do think that Q is like, this is probably his like fifth or sixth go around at the 12th grade, so he could very well be like 26 years old in this film. What's that scene when he goes into he's trying to get his locker open and he can't figure out the combo, and who is it? Yo, Calvin, what's the name? Who's the actor again?
It was Donald Faison, yeah.
Donald Faison in a cameo appearance comes by And like, he's like, damn, bro, it's been that long.
That was
great cameo for him.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was Faison.
I didn't even notice
that. That was Donald Faison.
Yo, the cameos in this movie
were ridiculous.
Like, what is EPMD? I think EPMD were in the bar that gets robbed by Blitz.
Oh, yeah, they were. Yeah. I remember that.
Yeah, yeah. And then, like, at the party, there's, like, a whole bunch of people, like, DJ Red Alert, and there's all kinds of people at the party. Yeah.
I mean,
there's, like, a bunch of cameos in this film.
I mean, and you're forgetting Samuel Jackson, Queen Latifah. Fab Five Freddy was another one, too. Tretch.
Yeah, yeah.
Tretch was another one. And it's funny because there's a story that says that I keep seeing that Tretch basically tried out for the role of Bishop, and I heard he knocked it out. I heard he did really well, and they said he had Tupac that was rolling with him, and he was just hanging out. So he asked him, like, yo, you want to read for the role? And he was like, yeah, what the hell, sure, why not? They said Tretch sat outside the room, and he said all of a sudden he's hearing chairs flying and shit in the room, and he said he basically ran inside like, yo, what the hell's going on? And he's like, nah, I was just reading the role for it, you know? And then by the end, like, by the time they left out, he was like, yo, I think you're going to get this role, man. He's like, I don't know about that. Let's see. And then he ended up knocking it out. So basically, like, Tupac kind of stole Tretch's big role, even though we had Naughty by Nature by then. But, you know, it's funny.
Is that a true story?
Yeah. Like, I've heard that multiple times. Like, he basically, like, Tretch and a couple, actually, from what I read, There was multiple rappers that basically were trying out for that role. They wanted to cast Bishop in that role, but they wanted a rapper to do it. They didn't want like an actor to do it. They wanted a rapper to do it, but they couldn't find anybody that could act out of the roles outside of, like, I guess they were impressed with Tretch, but Tupac was the one that really hit home.
Well, I think it's safe to say
Fresh Prince was out there.
Yeah.
Could you imagine?
Yeah, it was close. It was between Tupac, Will Smith, and Carlton, and Alfonso Cibriat, or whatever his name is, Ribeiro.
It would have been a very, very different temperature of the movie.
After he shoots Raheem, he does the Carlton dance, you know?
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, no, the cameos in this movie are on point.
It elevated the movie. I think it gave it the cosign too. You know what I mean? Like, seeing all that. Like, even it's funny, even in the beginning of the movie, just hearing Rakim, like, starting off the movie with Know the Ledge, like, it kind of just certifies the movie. Because especially, like, all the actors at that point, outside of Steel, we didn't really know anybody. Well, Steel and, I guess, Tupac a little bit, but we didn't really know any of the main actors, really. You know what I mean? So I think those cameos and stuff definitely helped.
And yo, you know what? Yeah. On a completely unrelated note, just the other day, actually, I watched this, even before I knew we were doing this, the scene where Q was doing the DJ battle before they did the Bosch robbery,
right,
when he did his set that won the competition, that shit was crazy dope. I mean, the last set, like his last set before the dude gave him the finger because he won. Like, that shit was crazy dope, man. I'm not even a DJ, and I kept on winding that, man. Like, the cutting up that guy was doing, man, like, woof.
You mean the DJ before him, or you mean like Q himself?
Q himself, his last set, like, you know, they were going back and forth, drowning each other out, and then his last set right before he won, like, you know what I mean, his last set that led to his victory. That was dope, man. The cutting up he was doing when he was scratching, man. Jeez.
I remember that being like those little West Indian flow in there, man. If people forget, like, you know, in New York City, a lot, like, the West Indian population here is massive, man. Like, that whole, like, it had that vibe. I remember it was. I'm trying to remember the rhythm, but, like, it was definitely like a West Indian influence kind of rhythm.
No, it's funny because when the podcast with the Juice soundtrack that I did, because I was doing it with Chris Dice and DJ G Sharp. It's funny, they're ripping it. Mm-hmm. They're ripping that DJ scene. They're like, yo, looking back on it now, they're like, that scene was horrible. So it's funny how everybody has, like, their different outtakes on it.
I mean, well, they're DJs, but I mean, for me personally, I mean, the entire battle, a lot of it was kind of crap. Mm-hmm. But I mean, just the last, and I don't even know if I'm using the right term, because I'm not a DJ. Maybe I say set, and that means the whole thing. Who knows? When he came with his last
set,
part, set, whatever.
Yeah.
To me, when he was like just cutting up and stopping the beat, like choo-choo, I was like, yo, that's dope. I don't know. I've been to a lot of parties. I never heard no one do that anywhere I've been. I'm not DJ Chris Nice, pardon me, but personally, to me, that sounded good, man. I don't know.
All right, let me move.
Never heard someone recreate that.
Let me move this along a little bit. What was your favorite scene in the movie? Was it the old man Quiles, the botched robbery? Was it the locker scene? Was it the final fight scene? Was it Raheem's reception service? Like, what was, or any other ones? You don't have to choose from those ones specifically. But what was like the favorite scene that you guys had in the movie?
I can say from a cinematic standpoint, definitely the scene where he's waiting for Bishop to show up. The way they play with light and shadow in that, and you know, like Q is standing there waiting in the light, and Bishop is like in the shadow. You can't see him. Mm-hmm. And then he kind of emerges and he attacks him from behind. You know, it's kind of like a cowardly act of coming and putting a gun to his head from behind him. Like, that to me, that whole scene from a cinematic standpoint alone is brilliant.
Yeah, he showed up like a again like a duppy. what's your idea, Sean?
For me, I would say was that locker scene, man. When mm-hmm. when Bishop gave his monologue, you know, everything starts from now, and I don't give a F about you. I don't give a F about Steers. I don't give a F about Raheem either. And I don't give a F about myself. And as soon as I figure you ain't shit,
bow. Yeah.
Like that. And when he was like, you know, and something like, I'm the one you worry about, partner. I'm like, I'm stealing that slang. Man, that partner, I use that all the time, boy.
I remember getting my hair cut, man, in high school from, like, you know, high school barber, going somewhere. We would, like, you know, you go up into the gymnasium or something during lunch break to get a haircut. And, like, that being the scene that we that people would memorize and just, like, reenacting that scene line for line. Mm-hmm. That was a scene, for sure.
Yeah.
You know how many people probably got really hurt based on Tupac's depiction of Bishop? Watch that movie.
Trying to be hard.
Yeah, people watched that movie and was like, you know what? That's a good point. Joe owed me $5. You know what I mean? Next day, took their Flyers hoodie, went to school, camped out next to the locker, and the rest is history, man. You know, honestly, how many people were motivated to emulate Bishop, man? Trust me, man.
I agree with you. I think that's also my favorite scene. But what I kind of like about it is just the beginning of that part, going back to Donald Faison, just the fact that with all the seriousness that happened right before that point, the fact that they threw that joke in there, like, damn, boy, it's been that long. Like, it kind of just lightened up the mood just for a little bit before it went back to play between Q and Bishop. Like, I thought that was actually like underrated. I thought that was great. That's a great part just to add, just that little subtle joke, to kind of just lighten up everything until, you know, like a few seconds later, then, you know, when Tupac had his should have been award nominated monologue there in that scene. I can't lie. That was amazing. I think the honorable mention goes to the elevator scene, and part of it is because of the, you know, social media, you know, resurrecting it with those two memes. You know, the first meme with, you remember the whole thing with Solange and Hove, like the meme had Q as Jay-Z and Solange as Bishop, seeing that part, and then for me the Instagram one, I think that was just last year, the Instagram one where they reenacted it, where the guy had his side piece in the elevator and his girlfriend's friend came in the elevator playing the role of a Bishop.
Oh, I saw that, actually.
And she had the phone like that. I mean, that's actually one of the best IG clips I think I've seen, period. Because just the Stone Cold look in her face was hilarious. Like, they did that shit perfect. But yeah, I think that was also like another scene too, where you're like, holy shit, like, yo, this guy is nuts. He just like he's like Jason at this point. You know, he can't escape this guy.
I think my favorite part about that scene though is how everybody reacts, is like the reaction of the other people. Mm-hmm. Like, immediately as soon as he pulls out the gun and shoots, there's a dude that like grabs his arm and starts struggling with him, and then the other, like, he gets the gun knocked out of his hand, and the other guy picks up the gun and puts it in his jacket. Like, nobody, like, skips a beat, and then everybody just keeps partying. Nothing. Like, it's nothing. This is some serious shit went down in this party, and everybody's still grinding up in this joint. Like, it's nothing. Like, with a red light on and everything.
Grinding to the classy lyrical sounds of Cypress Hill.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll ask another question here. And I think to me, this is probably the most important question. Why in the living hell did Q throw the gun in the river? One of you guys explain that to me, please. Because I, like, honestly, I don't understand it. Like, for me, like, first you saw him murder Raheem. You told him off on the lockers, and then he basically threatened your life. You bailed on him when Radamez and his crew ran up on him again. And then you know he saw you. And then you see Steel being carried off in an ambulance. You probably knew Radamez got shot. And then after that, you go and you get a gun. And after all that, and you decide to go meet with this guy, you throw the gun in the river. Now, I understand if, like, that's not in your makeup, like, in your character makeup. But I don't know, man. At this point, I think I'm kind of having to, like, rewrite my morality laws, my morality laws at that point. You know, because something's got to change at that point. Like, I'm no killer, but I'm walking out like the Punisher. Like, after that.
I tell you what, with that lack of a killer instinct, that even further substantiates my point that Q couldn't have bagged that older nurse. First of all, second of all, Calvin, I tell you what, I love you like a brother. Let me find out that you murked Headley out. And then you shot whoever else you want to mention. And I think you're coming for me, brother. They call Soulja Boy King Draco. They might as well call me King Draco. Because, Calvin, you will be a moving target. The only thing that would stop you is if I run out of bullets. I'll be like, shit, Calvin got away. Like, let me see if I could beat him with this empty gun. Like, throw the gun in the river? Poof. Man, if I was Q, man, I would have been hiding behind a garbage can waiting for Bishop to show his face. He couldn't arrive early enough for me to put a hole in him if that was me, man.
Oh, I'm with Sean on this one, man. I think, like, to be honest, I think the real GQ wouldn't have thrown that gun in the river either.
No.
But the writers are like, yo, we need the character to be sympathetic, right? Like, you need the character to be sympathetic without a doubt. There needs to be no doubt that he is the good guy. And the easiest way to do that is to make a clear divide. I mean, just from a straight-up storytelling perspective, that's like, the real answer. But in reality, I think we all know GQ ain't throwing away that gun. Of course. Hell no.
And if he did throw the gun in the river in real life, basically after, you know, Bishop shows up, you know, out of the shadows like Casper, he probably would have been dead on the spot. There wouldn't have been no elevator scene because you would have already been laid out in the street. You know, because, like, it made, like, honestly, even back then, I remember even watching that movie in the theater, like, even back then, I was like, that makes no sense. That makes it does not make any sense. Like, good guy and all, but you could be a good guy with a weapon too. You know, like, you're gonna talk your way out of it. Like, at this point, like, it's, you see he's clearly gone at this point. Like, it's past the point of no return. It's either him or you at this point. You know, so, I mean, you know,
and this is the whole thing though with the, like, if you've got a character and you want him to be the good guy without beyond a doubt. You create no doubt.
Having
an illegal gun where he kills Bishop, it creates a little bit of doubt. Like, this way, that it's like he's even trying to save him on the roof, right? He's trying to hold on to him and not let him die, right? All of that is, you know, for a reason. It's to, like, make his character, but there's no question that he was a good guy and he wasn't out to just kill Bishop.
I mean,
can we talk about the roof scene, though? Has anybody ever, like, thought about the fact that, like, so he's falling off the roof. So clearly that's going on for a minute, and he's, like, trying to hold on to him. He falls. He immediately just turns around to go walk off the roof, and there's, like, 20 people right behind him. Like, nobody was trying to help. Like, no one came in to try and help Bishop.
And that was just
watched him fall off the roof.
Why exactly were they drawn to the roof in the first place?
Like, how did they know?
Yeah, there was a party going on. Wasn't there music?
Well, not just that, but obviously you see him running through the crowd chasing after Bishop. Nobody cared then. Everybody kept dancing. It looked like they were high as hell, you know, and it's true. And then at the end, there's that one kid like, yo, you got the juice now. Like, what did you even see? You don't even know what the hell happened. Exactly. How do you know I got the juice?
Exactly.
I got the juice. I tried to save him. He fell.
You know,
obviously, I don't have the grip strength to be able to hold on to a grown person. How does that mean that I get your respect? Because I can't hold on to a man by his arm to keep him from falling from a building. Respect, man. I respect your game.
Man, if I was killed, I'd have been like, you know it. I would have gave him a high five. You damn right I got the juice. Some of my friends tried to kill me.
Damn it, Sean, you just missed the entire you missed the entire point of the movie. You're trying to get away from the principle of juice, man.
I'm right, I got
the whole lesson was totally lost on this guy.
I got the juice, and I'm the only one of my friends that got lucky in the whole movie. I'm the absolute victor in every way.
So, that being said, all with Sandy, like the whole party scene and all that, still I think the most implausible part of the entire film is the fact that Q bagged that girl. No, wait. Even more implausible is that that girl bagged Raheem and Special Ed.
Yep, that's true.
So,
and on top
and
of
let's
that,
keep in mind, she got Special Ed with a child, with a newborn.
So you're telling me Q throwing the gun in the river isn't part of that movie, like the part you don't understand the most? You think her bagging Raheem and Special Ed at the height of Just Got It Made, and Cindy bagging Q as like a 30-year-old, that's higher than Q throwing the gun in the river?
I don't know. Not even close.
I mean,
I don't think Q throws a gun in the river, but at the same time, I really do not think she gets Raheem and Special Ed. That just doesn't make any sense.
I think that's got to be the top most implausible thing. I mean,
I believe that there's like a law of physics that doesn't allow that to actually happen.
I mean, she didn't even have a body. Seems... You know what I mean? It's like it got to be one or the other. If she's gonna be, a mug face, she got to at least have a body. You're like, okay, I mean, I could. Or, you know, a body, a sweet personality. She seemed like a bitch anyway. So, one, she was a bitch. Two, she was ugly. And three, she didn't have a body. What kind of Obi was she working on these dudes, man? Didn't make any sense. But aside from that, like, don't get me wrong. Q, I think, like, at the end of the movie, I think we can all agree that Q was an idiot. For many reasons. I mean, one, like you said, he threw the gun away. Two, man, Bishop was trying to kill you. He ruined your life. Yeah, you guys were friends. Again, friendship's kind of over when you murder my other friends and then try to murder me. I think I could kind of say, you know, this might cause a little rift in our friendship at that point. And then when you're falling off the roof, then you say, don't let me go. I'm like, look at that go of my hand, man. What's wrong with you? At this point, can't we agree that, you know, we can't reconcile? Let go. Please don't let me go. Pick me up. And Q was trying to save him. You pull him, he'd still probably want to kill you later on.
It's true.
After you pull him up. No, Q was an idiot all around.
You know, thinking back on top of it, too, it's like, why would you meet him in that area? Like, I know where that is. That's 12th. They met at, like, 12th Ave and 125th, like, under the overpass. That's not a good place to go and meet somebody at night. Like, especially somebody who murdered your friends and has a gun. That's just bad decision making.
Boy, meet with no witnesses is probably not the best strategy.
He should have been like, yo, let's meet at McDonald's.
While at the same time throwing the gun in the Hudson. Yeah. Like if you're gonna do that, yeah, meet him in front of McDonald's like midday. Like meet him at like 2 in
there
the afternoon. Well, there's
like,
lots
hey, man,
of sunlight.
Like meet at midnight at 12th and 125th. You're like, oh, man, I'm kind of busy. Why don't we do it tomorrow at like 11 a.m.? Meet at McDonald's, maybe a church. There's got to be better options.
And just keep on adding fuel to the Q's and idiot fire. That was cool.
and Mambo, and Mambo, even if it's like, if it's cloudy the next day, you're like, nah, cancel it. We'll do it tomorrow. I think it's sunny Thursday. Let's do it Thursday. Like, as long as there's a lot of daylight.
Turn it off. and then you just stop answering his calls. Tell him I'm not home.
So let me ask this last question here. Would you watch a remake of this movie in 2017 and beyond?
No way.
No.
No butcher.
Something's just going to be that. No.
You know what? I'll say this. I think the only way I'll watch this again is I think it might work better as a TV show. Like, if you put it on Netflix and you space the story out a little bit, I could probably give it a chance that way. If you give me the binge watching option of watching it. Like, if it ends up on, like, say, like ABC or Fox, like friggin' like Lethal Weapon or Training Day, then hell no, I have no interest. And I think as a movie, yeah, I think there's some things in life, once it's done once, you gotta just leave it alone. Not everything needs to be remade, which I wish Hollywood would listen to that. Like, honestly, for me, I glaze over and disgust whenever I see the XXX reboot right now. You see all those commercials out with Vin Diesel. Every time I see those, it makes me angry. Every time I see that, because everything gets remade, yeah. Man, it's nonsense.
Yeah, I know.
There's like 9 million people live in New York City, man. You can make another movie like this easily with different characters and different everything, man. You don't need to remake this at all.
Yeah.
Some things just need to be left the way they were. They were done. It's not perfect. It's not like it's a perfect movie, but there is no real such thing as a perfect movie, man. So it was a great movie for its time. It needs to be, you know, left at how it is.
The thing is, I don't think that anybody can do the Bishop character justice. You know, I think that Tupac was a tough act to follow. So I think that anybody would be a downgrade. So because of that, I don't think it's possible. The only thing that I think you touched on this, Calvin, would have been if you do maybe like a prequel and then just, you know, go into, you know, trying to show what happened or you know, the history of the friendship and what builds up to the scene or the movie, you know what I mean? Then if they kind of added a little bit more context as to, you know, showing the different dimensions of the different characters and helping you understand why a certain person became a certain way, that might be interesting. But either way, they botched that, so I would advise against it. But that would be the only interesting way to put it on the one
problem though with doing a reboot is you need a lot of people to have seen the original, and as much as like this is a pivotal movie for us, this is probably a pivotal movie for a lot of people, you know, that listen to the show, but let's just be honest, this isn't exactly a mass marketed film that a lot of people know, so it's not like that you can this isn't Star Wars Episode 8, like, you know what I mean?
Actually, going back to your prequel idea, Sean, like, do you think, like, seeing that these guys were in high school, do you start it from like third grade? Like, do you start it like with Bishop like kicking Jenga projects off? You know what I mean? Like people tearing the heads off of Cabbage Patch Kids.
Yeah.
You're like teachers already in school. Like, I think we gotta write this kid up. You know,
you come in and graduate to throwing stones at dogs. You're like, oh, something's wrong with this guy.
But, I mean, that would even be, like, an interesting spin, Calvin. Like, you know, you show maybe there was a traumatic experience in Bishop's life, maybe involving his father, that, you know, he witnessed, it traumatized his father, he saw it, it traumatized, or, you know, it affected him. You know, there's a lot of interesting possibilities. But like you said, though, Mambo, there'd be such a small segment of the population that would be interested in that reboot that it would pretty much fizzle out, you know, really.
But yeah. I think it's also generational. Like for our generation, I think that was a huge movie. When I say our generation, I mean like our age group, you know, like our culture, black people and stuff. Like I think it could possibly work. Again, only in a situation like if it's Netflix or something like that. Like, that's the only way I would watch something like that. Otherwise, no. I would roll my eyes just like the rest of you guys if I saw, like, you know, Juice New Orleans, like, you know, like CIS or some stupidness like that. Like, yeah, like you know, I would roll my eyes and, you know, like, and try to keep my food down every time I see, like, those commercials for it, or if it was a movie, you know, or something like that. Like, I don't know if I would, I wouldn't know. I know I wouldn't want to watch that. Yeah. But I think that's the only way it would work. Like, just space it out and just work on it from there. Make them a little crazier. Well,
there is the fact that, like, I live in Harlem right now, and the Harlem that these guys are in is not the Harlem that you'd be shooting if you made a new film right now.
That's
like,
true.
We got a Whole Foods coming in here in like a year or two. So times are changing, my man. Harlem ain't the same.
It's like a hipster place now.
Exactly. It's changing. It's not there yet. It's not like, you know, it's not Brooklyn, like, not, but it's not like Williamsburg, but it's definitely changing. Like, gentrification is a real deal happening here in Harlem. So there's that big issue. Like, you can't shoot this film. It's not the same. The way that they have that scene where they're in the park and they scare that white guy to just go and boo, mm-hmm. like, that wouldn't work now.
Yeah.
Where people would be like, what the hell's wrong with you?
while filming them at the same time on their smartphone.
Exactly.
Anyways, on that note, fellas, thank you so much for coming on the app today talking about Juice, man. Thank you, partners.
Yeah, thank you, brother, for having me too, man. Much appreciated.
Yes, man.
Good trip down memory lane, my man. Good trip down memory lane.
Take care, man. Thank you once again for coming
on. All right, man. Be good, brother.
Thank you for tuning in to the AV Podcast. Big shout outs goes out to Sean Adonis and Andrew Mumble for taking time out of their day to come down memory lane to talk about one of the most influential movies from our generation. I hope you had as much fun listening to the podcast as we did doing it. If for some reason you haven't peeped the soundtrack edition of the podcast, make sure you click on part one right now. Well, wait a little bit first till I finish. Then click right above when we're done here and check us out as we break down the Juice soundtrack as well as the soundtrack era of the 90s. Once again, thank you for tuning in to the AV Podcast. To listen to more podcasts as well as previous ones and to check the blog, yes, I'll be doing more write-ups soon. Please subscribe to SouthShoreAV.com. Once again, that's SouthShoreAV.com. For Sean Adonis and Andrew Mumble, this is Cal C, and this is the AV Podcast on South Shore AV Radio. Until the next podcast, folks, peace. We out.